The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Well, it is the 9 till noon show. Very good Monday morning to you all. It's Michaela Clark in for Greg Hughes today. We've lots to come on the show as always, so make sure to stay tuned. You can also watch us live on highlandradio.com, our YouTube channel, or Highland Radio's Facebook page. But first, we're going to have a quick look at some of the stories making the papers today. You would have heard Donna Marie on the news there talking about the sentencing being handed down to the man accused of the rape and murder of Daniel McLaughlin. So in the Donegal news today, the man who was found guilty of the rape and murder of Bunkrana woman Daniel McLaughlin in India almost 8 years ago will be sentenced today. Well, we do know that 31-year-old Fakat Bhagat was sentenced this morning after being found guilty at the Magor Principal District and Sessions Court in South Goa last Friday. He received two life sentences, one life sentence for murder, another life sentence for rape, and a further 2 years for the destruction of evidence. Those sentences will run concurrently. Bhagat can apply for release after 14 years in prison, and he has already spent 7 years in prison. We will be speaking more on that shortly. The Donegal News writes, though, that Miss McLaughlin's mother, Andrea Branigan, and her sister, Jolene, travelled to Goa to hear the verdict on Friday. And if you're listening to the show on Friday, you will have heard them both speaking to Greg as well. Well, family solicitor Desmond Doherty issued a statement on their behalf following the conviction. He said there was no other suspect or gang involved in Danielle's death, and Fakat Bhagat was solely responsible for cruelly ending her beautiful life, the statement read. We have endured what has been effectively an 8-year murder trial with many delays and problems right until the end, all taking place thousands of miles away from Danielle's home in Bunkrana, County Donegal. We are content now with the judicial confirmation in public of what we already sadly knew. What further legal processes now take place, we will observe, the statement said. Then in a separate statement on the Truth for Danielle McLaughlin Facebook page, her family and friends thanked those who helped in their fight for justice, including both embassies, public prosecutors, lawyers and investigating officers. We are so thankful that their hard work has paid off and that Fakat has been found guilty of taking Danielle from us. We had Danielle in our lives for 28 years and we wish we could have seen the woman she would have become, but because of Fakat, she will be forever 28. We will never see her smile or hear her laugh, and we appreciate all that they have done for our campaign fighting for this outcome. It was a very long time coming, unfortunately, for the family. But justice, hopefully, they believe, has been served for them now. Looking now to the Derry News, jail for racist who posted threatening messages towards Mayor. A man described by District Judge Barney McElhome as a racist has been jailed at Derry Magistrates Court for posting threatening messages towards the Mayor of the city, Councillor Lillian Sinoy Barr. Kevin Barry McIntyre, 31, of Miller Street in Derry, had been convicted of two counts of sending messages of a menacing nature on May the 2nd and May the 4th last year. The court heard that the post about the North's first black mayor was headed terrorist alert and said Councillor Sinoy Barr would be removed from the city dead or alive. He was interviewed by police on May the 5th and responded that everyone leaves Derry dead or alive. He denied making threats and said that was simply one interpretation of the messages. Defence Counsel Michael Donoghue said his client had always accepted he had posted the comments but maintained that he did not intend to put anyone in fear. He said the messages were posted on McIntyre's own social media account and there had been no direct contact. The barrister said that perhaps the defendant had learned a lesson and suggested a community service sentence. We know that people in elected offices, they are subject to abuse all the time. The judge in this case also highlighted posts about the MP for Foyle at Colm Eastwood, where McIntyre said he was responsible for deaths due to the COVID vaccine. Judge McElhome said McIntyre deserves no consideration from this court, nor would he get any. Moving on now to the Irish Daily Mirror. Ireland has the second highest rate of new cancer diagnoses in Europe, a report has found. Despite the country being leaders in curtailing tobacco use, it has also been revealed that mortality rates from the disease, while improving, are the third highest in Western Europe. The biannual European Cancer Inequalities Registry shows that while deaths declined significantly between 2011 and 2021, it was still higher than most countries in the EU. The Irish Cancer Society is urging Health Minister Jennifer Carroll McNeill to expand screening services, have shorter waiting times for tests, treatment and faster access to new medicines. Its chief executive, Avril Pyer, said this comparative data highlights the sad fact that you're more likely to get and die from cancer in Ireland than in any other European countries. It must serve as a wake-up call to the government. Without urgent action, individuals and the state face an enormous cancer burden in the coming years. Much of this could be avoided by tracking the delays in diagnosis and treatment that are Ireland's biggest obstacles to improve outcomes. So while they're making such strides in certain areas, obviously a lot more work does need to be done, according to that report. And it is sad that, you know, we're still dealing with so much in terms of cancer that, you know, there has been great strides made, but, you know, people are ultimately still suffering and, yeah, a lot more does need to be done. Disgusting and unacceptable is the headline in the Irish Daily Mail today. Justice Minister Jim O'Callaghan has branded the violence in the capital in the early hours of Saturday morning, which left asylum seeker Quaim Babatunde dead and another man in hospital, as disgusting and unacceptable. Mr. Babatunde, 34, a Nigerian national, was found with serious knife injuries and was rushed to St. James's Hospital but died. A second man who also suffered stab wounds was treated at the same hospital for non-life-threatening injuries. Video footage being circulated on social media shows a masked man brandishing a large knife and people fighting on South Ann Street, located just off Grafton Street. A separate video of the aftermath of the incident also shows a man being treated for serious injuries. Gardaí believe both men had attended an after-swing gig in a club on the street before the stabbings took place and are investigating if they knew each other. Senior officers are probing whether two groups clashed following the gig in the 22 Dublin Club when they were called to respond to what they called a serious public order incident. Yesterday, in a message to residents on the Ballyogan iPass Centre, management said Mr. Babatunde was amongst the first iPass residents who were accommodated there. The statement said, in light of this sad event, anyone who has been affected, iPass has put in place support for both residents and staff to be able to get through this difficult time. That story also features on the front page of the Irish Times today. They also have some figures. The number of knives seized every year by Gardaí has risen by more than 50% on a decade ago, new data shows. More than 2,150 knives were seized last year, according to Garda figures. That they want then to talk about the murder investigation that has now been launched. Later in the article, they say new figures from an Garda Síochána show the Dublin region has recorded the largest number of knives seized over recent years. There were 1,050 seized across the division last year, up from 620 in 2015. Across the country, the number of knives seized rose by 1,362 to 2,157, up 58% between 2015 and 2024. The highest number of knives seized over the period was in 2020, when Gardaí confiscated 2,260. So it just shows you there the knife crime. And funny, I was listening to the radio coming down this morning and they were talking about, you know, knife crime and how people say Dublin city centre is a no-go area. And then the argument was, you know, I don't think it is a no-go area, but I think you could just be in the wrong area or wrong place, wrong time, unfortunately. Now, a story that we have covered numerous times is featured in the Irish Independent today. The headline reads, 10 people died, it can't be business as usual, Creaslough families react to plans. So families of the people killed in the explosion in Creaslough have expressed their deep hurt and strong opposition over plans to redevelop the site of the tragic blast. A decision is due on Wednesday over a controversial planning proposal to construct a new shop and filling station at the scene where 10 people lost their lives in October 2022. The plans originally submitted in April last year also include a small space for a memorial garden as well as a proposed memorial lighted feature to commemorate the dead. Over 30 objections have been lodged to the proposal, including dozens of pleas from grieving family members to stop the development. Charlie Flood, who lost his partner Catherine O'Donnell, who was 39, and her son James Monaghan, who was 13, described the plans as deeply hurtful. This site, he says, is very sensitive for obvious reasons. What is being currently proposed would serve as a lasting and painful reminder of this devastating loss we have suffered. My feeling is that this should be built somewhere else and that the entire site should be turned into a memorial garden for the whole community. The article does feature another family as well, speaking out about the plans and what their thoughts are on that. The Irish Daily Star now, more than 900 people recruited to the Defence Forces since 2020 left within less than 5 years. New figures show 837 men and 65 women resigned their post. This included members from across the force, from cadet to commandant, according to data released by the Defence Forces. The military strength in numbers has been in decline in recent years and fell below 7,500 last year. The figures show 43 cadets and 637 recruits left within 5 years of having joined up in the period since 2020. A further 7 apprentices, 175 privates and 11 corporals also departed not long after becoming members of the Defence Forces. The data showed 11 corporals and 5 sergeants, whose careers appear to be progressing, left the army as well. There were departures too from the commissioned ranks, with 2 ensigns, 4 lieutenants and 4 sub-lieutenants leaving within 5 years. Finally for now, The Sun. I don't know if you've been following the Eurosong drama. It provided great entertainment last week, but Brian Dowling believes singer Samantha Mumba crossed a line after her personal digs aimed at his hubby Arthur Garulian. Samantha, aged 42, criticised the Late Late Show's Eurosong judging panel, which Arthur was part of, after losing out on her chance to represent Ireland at Eurovision. The irate star especially rounded on RTÉ's decision to have Arthur as a judge and wrote online, "A dancer with no formal training critiquing a songwriting contest is laughable at best." But Brian hit back, saying Arthur trained himself. He was living in Armenia. He was a refugee. There was a war going on. There were bigger things to do than learn to dance. So he trained himself. It didn't stop him touring the world with so many amazing people. So what do you think? Any of those stories pique your interest, get in touch. Let us know. We're taking all comments and any issues you would like to raise today. So as always, you can text and WhatsApp the show, 086 60 25 000. You can call us on 074 91 25 000, and you can also email comments at highlandradio.com, or why not send us a voice note on WhatsApp as well. Now, you will have heard that 31-year-old Fakat Bhagat was sentenced this morning after being found guilty on Friday last in Goa of the rape and murder of Bunkrana woman Danielle McLaughlin. I'm joined now on the line by Danielle McLaughlin's family solicitor, Des Doherty. Good morning to you, Des.
Good morning.
So, Des, can you outline a bit for us what happened this morning?
Well, this morning was the day set for the sentencing of Bhagat, but you know, we had discussed this at length even prior to the conviction, if there was a conviction, about what could happen or what would not happen. And really, I suppose what we were looking at was the possibility of a death sentence even, or life imprisonment. So life imprisonment was imposed in the case this morning, together with some further sentencing in respect of the destruction of evidence, so to speak, I suppose, which was Danielle's belongings and that. So technically, from a legal point of view, the matter is now finished in terms of the trial as of this morning now with the sentence.
And have you spoken to the family? Was it a life sentence they were hoping for?
Well, Andrea had always said in advance of this, because again, this was a matter that we had discussed, you know, at length prior to today, is that this would always be a matter for the court. And she didn't want to interfere or be critical. And I think it, all your listeners will agree that she's conducted herself with the highest degree of dignity that could be shown in the horrific circumstances of the case. So life imprisonment, you know, is a maximum in terms of that scale of a sentence. Obviously, it can't be anything more. So In that way, justice has been achieved. Ricketts has been convicted and he's received a life term. So from the criminal point of view, there's nothing more that could be achieved.
And is there a suggestion now or a possibility that this sentence could be appealed on his behalf?
Well, in the same way that the sentence is a matter for the court, any appeal is a matter for the defence and the defendant. It's not uncommon, you know, in any jurisdiction, you know, our own included, that a defendant would publicly say or intimate that they're going to appeal the sentence the minute it is pronounced. So I don't know any of the details of that, but that really isn't for today, because a defendant obviously can appeal either against the sentence itself but not appeal the conviction, or a defendant could appeal against the conviction and the sentence. But again, that's a matter for the defendant and the defendant's lawyers, which under due process and in the law, any defendant is entitled to do if an appeal is open to them.
And this has been such a journey for the McLaughlin and Branigan families. It's been in court over 200 times. Do they feel that today is a significant day, that they can draw a line under this?
Yeah, well, I think Andrea said this morning that she was simply just glad it was over, because it has been exhausting. But what I would say, which is different from legal systems in Western Europe to a large degree, what was different is that in this case, under the Indian penal system, Andrea was granted, as Danielle's mother, a right of representation at the court with her own lawyer. So we were able to instruct a gentleman in India, Mr. Vikram Varma, to represent Andrea's and the family's interest at the trial in India. So he had a seat at the trial assisting the prosecution. Now, we weren't allowed to cross-examine or question witnesses, but we had a presence at the trial, unlike what sometimes you find in many criminal trials in our own jurisdictions, is that the family may turn up at a trial to view it, and they may speak and the prosecutors may advise them what is happening. But in this case, we actually had a presence in the trial, which was very, very helpful because of the distancing of the event. Now, obviously, the frustration arose with the fact that the court did not sit every day. You know, the trial did not start and then sit from Monday and from 10 o'clock until 4 each day, 5 days a week. It sat one day and then it would sit 2 days and sometimes not sit at all. And that dragged the trial process out, but also as well in the middle of it, people shouldn't forget that we had the pandemic, and that obviously then caused major delays and major problems. So it has been a very, very long process, and it has been 8 years. But Andrea would say, she was saying last week, and when I was speaking to her before she had left, you know, it just felt like yesterday. It felt so close. She can't believe that the 8 years, you know, has gone by. But I'm sure she'll be glad to get home back to Bunkrana. I'm certain of that.
Yeah, because she has been relentless, and rightly so, in campaigning to expedite the trial you said there about, you know, it's been ongoing now for so long. And she has been great in, you know, making those representations to different governments to try and finally get answers for herself.
Yes, well, I mean, that is another factor that particularly learned in this case, is that the assistance of the Irish consulate and the British consulate as well really was fantastic. I was very, very much impressed with that, because it very much assisted me, because we were relying on information that was flowing back and everything had to be confirmed. And when you had confirmation from the consular staff, on top of the confirmation from Mr. Varma, it was extremely helpful, because, again, in the times that we are in the world that we live in, at the early stages of the trial and at the early stages of the investigation, of course, Andrea was, you know, fed a lot of information, and her family would have been, as anybody would have been, and a lot of young people, by social media. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was incorrect and it was wrong. And I remember long conversations with Andrea in her living room, you know, analysing some of the reports in social media and what was said and not said and what was being said in court and not said. And the majority of it was incorrect. So to have the official confirmation and to work with the consular staff and the lawyer in India was testament to Andrea, because, you could find somebody for entirely different reasons wouldn't be able to deal with that level of, I suppose, legal bureaucracy and political bureaucracy, because it's quite difficult.
Yeah.
Because you must be very patient, you must be very polite, and you must respect the process. So if Andrea had to be political, too much, I suppose, of the Indian legal process or the consular staff, well, you would find then in reverse, you may not have got so much help. And one other factor as well, which I noticed during the course of this, was the fact that while the British and the Irish consular staff were all extremely helpful, because the case went on for so long, you would find that the staff changed or they moved on to new jobs or to different departments.
Right.
So you built up a relationship with the individual, you know, for 6 months to a year. And then you would they would understand Andrea, you know, have a good sense of contact, but then they would move to a different department and you had to go through the whole process all over again. But Andrea, again, you know, to your credit, was very patient with that and stuck with it.
Yeah, because I imagine all that adds to the grieving process. It adds to the stress of the whole thing. And I suppose for yourself, it's great having, you know, Andrea, having yourself here, but having that representation in India, as you mentioned there, going through the reports, the things seen on social media, that could have been very distressing if you hadn't have had the representation in India.
Well, you couldn't have put it better. I mean, that is exactly the position, because I wouldn't have it any other way, because, I would never react or even try to overanalyze anything that is said in social media. And it was very, very, very common. And I advised Andrea, you know, not to do that either, to only rely on the official line on each occasion, because it was very, very upsetting. Totally understanding. You would get people in social media thought that they were helping, but they may have misinterpreted what was said in court, or may have misinterpreted the evidence. But all I can say from my point of view, from the very, very early stages, even, you know, within days or weeks of the event happening, and after Danielle's funeral, even the police officer and the police at the time were in contact with me, and they were able to give me official information. And it was difficult at the start. It was very difficult. You've got to build these relationships. There has to be an element of trust. And also as well, I mean, they were able to send me documents as well. And you've got to remember that the public would not be aware unless they attended the trial, but it's not really a public knowledge here. The extent of the violence inflicted upon Danielle by Baguette. Mm-hmm. And we had a pathology, a post-mortem report in India. And one of the key things that I think Andrea did, and one of the great successes again in the case, was that in consultation with me, is that when Danielle's body was brought back to Ireland, we then requested our own post-mortem here. Mm-hmm. By the state pathologist at the time, Marie Cassidy. So again, that was, you know, that was a technical, legal positive thing to do, because that actually confirmed what was in the Indian pathology report to a large degree. And again, difficult as it was, it did give Andrea some confirmation of exactly what happened to her daughter. Otherwise, she may never have known. So all those very dense legal processes and all the legal processes are very, 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 very difficult. That's why I think that it was great that she had this representation at the court, which is the first time I've been involved in a case whereby the family of a victim has a right to representation at the court, a seat at the court to help with the prosecution, because otherwise, you're relying on what you can find out, sometimes even in the media yourself, or from other lawyers who are there, because you don't have any rights of audience before the court. So it worked out quite well. And also, the timing, difficult again as it was, worked out quite well, because it was no easy matter trying to anticipate when the verdict and the sentencing was going to be. There was a lot of work went on in the background. And so for Andrea then to organise with her daughter Jolene and her friend and Danielle's friend Louise, all from Buncrana, to be able to organise, you know, just to physically get to India and deal with all that was another major success. And the timing worked out quite well, because obviously their flights are back now this evening. And as I said earlier, I'm sure Andrea and her family, or just Jolene and Louise will be really hoping to get home as quickly as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks so much, Des, for joining us and giving us a bit of an insight into how the case worked there as well. And we hope now Danielle's mum and sister and friend have a safe trip home, and hopefully now they've received the justice that they wanted and they were campaigning for many years. Thank you, Des. Now, you may have seen that managers at the National Ambulance Service have been instructed not to bring their staff vehicle home and out of hours until a dispute over benefit in kind has been resolved. The instruction has been confirmed by the HSE. In a statement, it said the HSE must comply with Revenue Commissioner regulations in relation to what, in this case, is the potential personal use of publicly owned vehicles. All HSE employees are covered by these rules. I'm joined now by Dr. Pádraig McGuinness, Donegal GP. Pádraig, what is the current situation here? Can you outline how this affects, particularly us here in Donegal?
Good morning, Michaela, and thanks for having us on to talk about this really important issue for patients across Donegal, but particularly across the rural areas in Donegal. This all stems from the fact that there are seven senior ambulance personnel from Donegal, several across the country, but the seven in Donegal specifically, who bring home their ambulance jeeps at the end of an evening and park them in rural areas and communities across Donegal. Then they respond in their own time, voluntarily, where they are not getting paid, to emergency call-outs that the ambulance crews might get, and they respond to those calls in a timely manner in rural areas across the county. So the current status quo before this was that those ambulance personnel did not have to pay benefit in kind. I think it's important to describe, Michaela, what benefit in kind is, because it really comes to the crux of this. So benefit in kind, as most people will know, is when the revenue commissioners will charge a tax on a non-monetary benefit that employees get from their employer. And as in from last Monday, the revenue have said that these ambulance personnel that are bringing home their vehicles should be charged a benefit in kind, because it's somehow a benefit to the ambulance personnel as opposed to a benefit to the community, which of course it is. So this is not like getting an Audi A5 that you can bring your kids to school in, or that you can, you know, that you can drive on a Saturday to the football with. This is getting
absolutely essential.
That's essential. That's jam packed full of really life saving equipment. And this sort of change to the status quo is life threatening, Michaela. And that's why, as GPs, we're coming out in force today, and we're coming out in support of our ambulance colleagues, because actually this change is going to cost lives.
And I think we always argue that Donegal does need to be looked differently to parts of the rest of the country. But say, like in Dublin, they have greater access to healthcare. They're in closer proximity to, say, hospitals. But in Donegal, that is not the case at all.
Absolutely, Michaela. I mean, I'm talking to you here from Fannet Head this morning, and our ambulance response time, if there is one available in Letterkenny, and as we all know, there are issues with getting ambulances. So if I ring for one now, or if a patient in Fannet Head rings for one, the ambulance response time is between 40 minutes and an hour. So I have one of these absolutely fantastic ambulance personnel living locally, John Joe McGowan, and he is a phenomenal individual who, in my knowledge and in my time, has saved at least five lives that I'm aware of because of his quick ambulance response times. So that instead of that 40 minutes, an ambulance personnel car with all of the equipment that's in an ambulance except for a stretcher can be here in 4 to 5 minutes. That's life-threatening. That's life-saving. And as a result, this is now a life-threatening change to the status quo. And I don't think it's okay. And I don't think anybody should think that it's okay. What these people are doing is saving lives. And what we're doing is we're now going to punish them and force them to leave their cars parked in Letterkenny and bring home no equipment at nighttime. And instead, that equipment is going to be sitting 40 minutes to an hour away from when it's actually needed.
Yeah, it just does not make sense. Say, for instance, you get an emergency call, you go out, your own vehicle doesn't start. That's an extra delay, never mind having to travel then to get to the ambulance to drive it then to the patient.
I mean, absolutely. It's a phenomenal nonsense, really. And it's a nonsense created by a bureaucratic system somewhere where revenue commissioners have decided that ambulance personnel should be treated the same as any other member of the HSE staff. And that's just not true. They just don't do the same thing. And, you know, the ambulance personnel, I have seen them. I have seen John Joe and others go out when they're out for dinner and they get a call and they're off they go and their own family life is disturbed, or they're sitting down to watch Netflix like the rest of us do in the evening time, and instead they're jumping up and responding to calls. You know, this is a benefit to the community, not a benefit in kind to those individuals. And it's not acceptable. Another blow to healthcare in rural Ireland that's already under pressure, that's already struggling. And I'm worried about my patients and their safety having to wait for an hour to get an ambulance when there could be one sitting 4 or 5 minutes away.
And do you anticipate that there could be any U-turn on this?
Look, Michaela, there has to be a U-turn on this. That is just the reality. I mean, I think it's important to the context of this is our government, their first piece of legislation was that they increased the amount of junior ministers, and they increased the amount of that those junior ministers got paid. For context, they all get a ministerial car, which is parked in rural communities with a driver. They do not pay benefit in kind. So why would we then treat, you know, ambulance personnel that are actually working day and night, voluntarily, I might remind everybody, voluntarily responding to calls, and now we are going to charge them a benefit in kind that's just not sustainable, so they'll leave the cars at the base rather than bringing them home. There has to be a U-turn here, Michaela, and that U-turn has to come from the ground up. So if you're listening to this today and you are living in rural areas across Donegal and you think that this service should not be removed from you, then you need to let people know that that's not okay. Like I'll be doing today, I'm writing to the minister today. I'm also going to speak to all of the five TDs in the county today, and I'm going to remind them that this is a blow, a life-threatening change to the status quo, and it needs to be reversed today.
Well, one of those who you speak of on the ground is Debbie McLaughlin. She joins us as well this morning. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning, Michaela, and good morning, Dr. McGuinness.
So, Debbie, you're one of those that's affected, and you are obviously concerned about this.
Oh, I'm deeply concerned. I'm deeply concerned for my family and for the community, and it's just a big blow for us, you know. And we've relied on JJ McGowan for nearly 8 years. He's been serving our community and responding and saving lives, Michaela. Like, I personally know at least 3 lives that has been saved because of this service and the response times, you know, quicker, as I say, and as Dr. McGuinness pointed on, the waiting times for our ambulances in our rural areas could be up to an hour. That's providing there's one in Letterkenny, whereas JJ is on your doorstep within 10 minutes.
And what,
you know, it's shocking.
If you yourself were to travel to the hospital, how long would that take you, Debbie?
Well, I'm here now in Kerrykeel, Michaela, so providing, you know, yourself, traffic and all that, you are looking at a good 35, 40 minutes.
Mm. And you yourself had an incident, did you, where you did call upon JJ?
Yes, I did. Thank you for taking that up. My son awoke one night with breathing difficulties, like he was struggling. So we rang 999 and JJ landed into my kitchen within 10 minutes, administering that medication to help him breathe while we waited for an ambulance to come. And we have no doubt that night that if we didn't have JJ, our son would have been gravely, gravely ill, and maybe worse, he could have died, you know.
And that is the stark reality, Dr. McGuinness, that it's not a case of if, it's a case of when something could happen.
Well, look, it happens every day of the week, and that's just the reality of healthcare in rural areas. And we're so lucky to have individuals in rural areas who have skills like this, and we should be rewarding them. We shouldn't be punishing them for it. I mean, this is what we're responding to here is things like heart attacks and cardiac arrests, or strokes, or car accidents. And they're time-sensitive things where you need people there with equipment and with skills, and you need them there soon. And, you know, I really am calling on our politicians, particularly the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil ones, who hold the ministries for finance and for health, to reverse this really simple action. It can be done with a stroke of a pen with a ministerial order where they just exempt senior ambulance personnel from benefit in kind on vehicles. I mean, it's a no-brainer. Everybody wants it. It's not costing the state any money, and it's just bureaucratic nonsense.
And Debbie, you're planning to kind of gain a bit of momentum here as well and organise a public meeting around this.
Yes, Michaela, that is the plan. Obviously, we're all hoping that hopefully this week it might be overturned, or we'll have a bit of information on where this is going. But if it's not overturned, yes, I will be going back on Facebook and social media, and I will be holding a public meeting.
Great. Well, Debbie, you can get in touch with us with any details and we'll be happy to share them. I'm also joined by Councillor Liam Blaney, Fianna Fáil councillor. Councillor Blaney, you agree with Dr. McGuinness. This is a very wrong decision.
Yeah, good morning, Michaela. And I agree with both Debbie and Dr. McGuinness. The decision is totally wrong. And, you know, there's only seven, as Dr. McGuinness said, in this county, maybe only about 40 or 50 nationwide. And I don't think it'd be a massive, you would think it should be a massive problem to get it overturned. As has been stated there, the lives has been saved. And this area alone, due to one of the ambulance officers that lives in this area, you know, it is, money does not, cannot, at any cost, lives saved is not, as a massive cost, a massive, sorry, savings to the department and to the health system whenever you have somebody like this in your area doing it voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And it has to be said, it has been done voluntarily, out of hours, during the night, during a time when they're away somewhere at something else, they get the call, they drop tools, and they land at the scene a lot quicker than when it takes for the ambulance to come down from Letterkenny, especially when you're chatting about remote areas like here in Fannett and like other remote areas in the county. And I think it is totally unjust and totally wrong, this decision that has been made, and hopefully it can be overturned. And they sent me, my brother Niall has been on to both the finance department and the health early last week, and looking for them to overturn this decision. And there's work ongoing there as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, well, hopefully, as Dr. McGuinness did call on there, those in power can make representations. Thanks, Councillor Blaney, for joining us this morning.
Thanks,
Michael. So, Dr. McGuinness, we've heard from the community there. There's a couple of comments I'll get to now shortly as well. This is something you will obviously not be lying down. We've seen, you know, whenever you've made representations about the situation in the hospital, the minister did come and visit. So are you hoping that this can have a similar effect?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like, hell had no fury for Donegal people when you try and cross them. And I think we proved last year when we had our campaign with the minister, and we brought the minister down to meet us, and we got several things done. I know it feels like it's a slow turning of the Titanic, but we have improved lots of services. Our AMAU is open. We have a bus to Galway every day. Our cancer waiting times are down. We have better access for lots of things. Lots more to do, of course, Michaela. But I suppose in similar to that campaign, we don't take things lying down in Donegal. And in the same way that if we have to take this campaign to Dublin again and to some senior figures in which to get this overturned, we will. It'll also be brought up at the health forum, is my understanding, in the next few weeks as well. So look, we're going to work on this in the background. We're not going to let it happen. And for our patients to suffer and for patient safety to suffer, this is a life-threatening change to the status quo. And we just simply cannot let it happen.
Yeah, well, we'll be watching it very closely, and hopefully people power will prevail again. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Dr. McGuinness.
Thanks, Michaela.
Now, a couple of comments coming in. It's time a petition was set up against this. Another disgrace. The HSC are wasting money everywhere and then trying to do cuts to something else. That's very essential. Hi, I'm from Fannett. In 2022, I found my dad collapsed and in cardiac arrest in his rural farmhouse near Dobeg. I had to start CPR and was on my own until first responder JJ McGowan arrived. After being on my own for quite some time, I can't put into words how relieved I was to see him. He was the first to attend and one of the last to leave. His professionalism, dedication and kindness are second to none. This service is essential and must not be lost in our area. Yeah, exactly. You can just imagine, you know, that speaking to Debbie there as well, how essential this service is. And it just, yeah, it's crazy thinking that, you know, you have to travel, say, 40 minutes to get to the ambulance, 40 minutes then back to respond to the emergency call. So, yeah, we'll be keeping a close eye on that one. Now, we received an email. It goes, I am writing to you as I'm becoming very concerned about the safety of a family member who works in the hospital. He works in and around the emergency department and has assisted in several difficult situations recently because he doesn't want his colleagues getting hurt. This relates to Letterkenny University Hospital, by the way. As you are aware, where a security officer was recently attacked, which resulted in him having to go off on long-term sick due to the injuries he received. In recent days, another security officer was attacked and injured, resulting in him having to receive medical treatment. He is now also off work due to the injuries he suffered at his workplace. Last year, a different security guard was attacked while doing his patrols and had to be medically retired due to his injuries. I'm joined now by Councillor Jerry McMonagall, and it is a bit scary that we're actually talking about this. Good morning, Councillor McMonagall.
Good morning, Michaela. Yeah, look, it's shocking that the number of attacks on staff at University Hospitals on the increase, and that as a result of those attacks that members are off sick and indeed were retired under medical reasons, and I wish all them a speedy recovery. But this is not a new thing. It's been happening for a number of years. I know I've raised it on a number of occasions around the number of security personnel employed by the hospital and put that at Letterkenny University Hospital's emergency department, because as we know, I mean, there's hundreds of people there on any one day, and particularly at night time and at the weekends, it could be a very fractious place. And we've had people who are there as a result maybe have an injury but are under the influence of drink or drugs, and it's causing alarm among the staff and has been for quite a while. So, you know, I think the hospital needs to look at this. They need to employ more security personnel. I don't think that it's suitable that they have depend on porters who have their own work to do to intervene in and support the one or two security personnel that are on duty at any one shift. So I would certainly call for the hospital to look at how many security people they have employed at the hospital and to increase that numbers due to the fact of the attacks are arising and the amount of people who attend the emergency department.
And do we know at this stage if these attacks are being carried out by people under the influence?
Well, I mean, from you talk to the staff there, they would tell you that a lot of the time it is people who are under the influence of drink and drugs. And drugs is really alarming because whatever about someone under the influence of drink, you can nearly talk sense to them. And without violence happening, you can get them to settle down. But it looks like when people are under the influence of drugs, anything could happen. And there's a lot of that there happening. And look, another concern that the staff have raised with me is the fact that Gardaí, who maybe arrest someone, they need medical treatment, that they take them up to the emergency department and leave them there, and then they leave within a short period of time. And my information is the most recent attack resulted in that, and where the person became violent, and as a result, now we have one of the security personnel off sick due to his injury. So, you know, there's a role for the hospital, but there's also a role in relation to the Gardaí when they bring people to the accident emergency to ensure that they behave themselves and that they stay there long enough to ensure everything's okay.
And it's a very difficult situation because obviously if someone needs medical attention, they need to be cared for. But is there any system in place that they can be put into a different room until, say, they calm down, depending on their injuries?
Well, look, we know the restrictions in relation to space at the emergency department that we have. It's just not big enough for what people are there already. But people need to understand, too, that, you know, when you're in need of medical attention, you're going to the place where you're going to be treated and looked after really well. You know, and I can't understand why people would take their anger out on someone who's actually doing good for them and helping and assist them. You know, people's mindsets need to change. It's not in relation to, oh, let's have a special room and put them in there. People just need to change how they behave. And when they go into accident emergencies or wherever, that if they're being looked after, by doctors, by nurses, by the porter staff. Whoever's on the hospital, should it be the receptionist that takes their names and details and all, they need to be polite. They need to be patient and understand that they're not the only ones there. But I know, all right, when people's under the influence of drink or drugs, that they don't think like that. But, you know, in that case, we need to ensure, and the hospital needs to ensure, that there's enough personnel, security personnel, who are well-trained to deal with this. And sometimes prevention is better than the cure. You identify early days if someone is going to kick off, then maybe an early intervention there, talking to them, you know, calming them down. Not, you know, there's not enough security there that because of other if other work they do around the hospital, so they're not all 100% in the emergency department all the time. So this is where the porters, and I see a response from the hospital that the porters are trained in anger management and all that, and that's fine, but that's not their job. Their job is to deal with patients, to get them.
And if, for instance, a porter was, you know, off taking someone to the x-ray department and an incident broke out, you know, they're not there to provide that additional service.
No, that's, I mean, their job is to ferry them back and forward. So of course, in the course of that type of job, you would get anger management training because you're dealing with the public and you're dealing with situations at times that upsets people. What we're talking about here primarily is the accident emergency department, especially in the evening times when people are under the influence of drinking drugs, and the significant number of people that attends our emergency department now, there is not enough security personnel there to deal with any given situation. And now we're two down. There's two off sick now at the minute. And I would like to know what is the hospital. And I've actually asked the hospital this, and we're waiting for a response from them as to what they're doing to keep the quota and numbers of security up to the level it was.
Yeah, well, definitely a very serious issue that does need to be addressed. Counselor McMonagall, thanks for joining us this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Well, that's the first hour of the 9 till noon show over. The news at 10 is up next, and we'll be back just after that.
The 9 till noon show is brought to you by Letterkenny Credit Union. Digital loans now available. Apply online or via our app today and get your loan transferred directly to your current account.
Ah, that's the sound of Caller, of cosy movie nights in.
Shove over.
Of the post-match get the cold out of your showers. A fry-up on a Sunday morning. It's the sound of homes running on easy, efficient energy. And right now, homes not on the gas network can get a free boiler by switching from oil to Caller gas for their home energy and heating. So every day sounds a little more like this.
Nice and toasty in here.
Caller, the energy that connects us. Terms and conditions apply. See callergas.ie for details.
Packing passports and racing to check in. Holiday prep can be pure chaos. For your travel money, that's one essential you can tick off long before you leave. Pop into your local post office today and sort your travel money in cash or card instantly. Or sign up for a card in the OnPus Money app and top up before you go. No commission on foreign currency, no need to pre-order, no fuss. Visit your local post office today. OnPus Money. Make your money matter more.
T's and C's apply. OnPus Money currency card is issued by PPS EUSA pursuant to license by MasterCard International. PPS EUSA is authorised by the National Bank of Belgium and is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland for conduct of business rules. OnPost is authorised by the Minister for Finance to provide foreign currency cash.
Get the job done with the right tools or equipment from Watson Hire in Letterkenny. From power tools to hand tools and diggers to dumpers, you'll find all you need at Watson's. Scissor lifts, generators, power washers, whatever you need to get the job done. For a fast and reliable hire service, contact Watson Hire, Liss Nennan, Letterkenny on 916-7777.